If you put stuff out there and doing stuff, maintenance, in case they added a phased array antenna, automatic phased array antenna, to help the Russians communicate better. Couldn't find the frequency, and I couldn't find a picture of the antenna, so I was very unhappy about that too. All I can tell you, it was an automatic phased array antenna. We got a little tired toward the end of the day. The one job is to disconnect this piece of equipment that was holding, it had test samples on board. They were done with this piece. Took them like an hour, took a couple of minutes to unbolt the contraption and deorbit it. They threw it away from the space station. They were quite frustrated with that. All in all, they got it done. But as far as we're concerned, they haven't launched anything quite NASA lately. Commercial people are still at it, but they're slowing down. For instance, there's one rocket that's been trying to get off the ground. Oh, it's got to be a month and a half at least now. Probably four or five delays. In fact, it was supposed to go up last Thursday and then Friday to a possible Saturday. One time it's a problem with the Falcon rocket on the second stage. Another time Saturday it was a weather-related problem. I thought they were going to have a weather-related problem today, but you know, it turned out to be another technical problem. And probably with the Falcon rocket. It was never explained what the first problem was. And SpaceX, they've been open all along, but now they're getting a little tight-lipped. They have their own TV webcast, you know, for launches. But all of a sudden, they stopped that on Saturday and Sunday, no webcast. Some people, of course, I'm one of them, very unhappy about that. And there's news media from some Florida outfit down there that's giving some information out, but very little. And SpaceX's attitude is, they actually came out and they said, well, these things are becoming more common, and so we're going to stop the webcast. Not from what I'm thinking. I just don't think they want the bad press. But who knows? To me, the American public should be interested in this. This one booster that's going to go up on the Falcon 9 has legs on there, four legs. It's going to open up and try to come back close to land, but it's going to land in the water. And maybe this time we'll get better pictures. Maybe that's an interest that the public should have. So it's a private company that's launching it, and it's launching it for another private company. Orbcomm 2 is the satellites that are going up. And they're launching half a dozen satellites this time, and they're going to do at least two more launches each time they launch multiple satellites. And put it to Orbcomm 2. What these satellites do are machine-to-machine type communication. They're basically repeated to machines. You know, a boat might transmit where it is to another machine, and different trucks and vehicles. And this Orbcomm 2 has, you know, big commercial interest in doing what they do. But SpaceX's attitude now is, well, it's a private company we're launching for, and we're a private company. We don't have to put this on. The American public shouldn't have to be interested in this. And that's not good. If they're testing the legs, eventually we're going to be looking at those legs on a regular basis. If what he predicts is going to come true, comes true. They'll be landing on land. And they have to shoot astronauts into space. They'll go up in the Dragon V2, the new spacecraft. The boosters will come back down and be reusable. I mean, that's an interesting find. There's no NASA money involved, but Now, because of that, NASA won't put it on TV even. Drop it. So, they have a possible launch coming up in a couple of days on the 20th. I think it would be the 24th. 20th is the next possible day. They're going to try to launch. Well, we'll see. So much for that. They're having their problems. I think SpaceX wants to launch. They have like 50 different satellites on their manifest. And right now they're lucky to get three or four up off for the year the way they're going. So hopefully they pick up the pace. They need to double the size of their building, double the amount of people that are working for them. And they need to keep putting out like two or three Falcon 9s a month instead of one. They're pretty much doing now. One of the other spacecraft maybe you read about, Dick, is the Rosetta one. We've been covering that on the net. Rosetta. That's the one that European Space Agency launched. Probably 20, almost 10 years ago, I guess. That's one that's going to go to Comet 7P. And it's catching up to it. It's been a long run for the spacecraft, but they're getting there now. Spacecraft is about half the distance between, let's say, the Earth and the Moon. That's like a little over 100,000 miles. So it's catching up to the comet slowly. They're doing that. We'll get to the comet in August, go into orbit around it, so it'll be the first time the spacecraft goes into orbit around the comet. And a few months later, in November, this fall, have a lander that's going to disconnect from the Rosetta and land on the comet, attach itself to it. And then after that, it'll continue to follow this comet all the way around the sun to the perihelion and then back out again all the way to Jupiter. And my guess is after that, they'll have an extended mission. That's usually the way this goes. So that's pretty much it for Rosetta. I know I've covered that before on that, but since they're getting close to orbiting in August, I thought I'd bring that up again. To get the spacewalk in Rosetta. And, of course, SpaceX is up there. You have orbital science probably will go up next month, beginning of July, with the Cygnus spacecraft to the International Space Station. We'll look forward to that. If they get their problems worked out, one of their test rockets blew up on a, or not blew up, but severely damaged the area, the facility where they test rockets in Mississippi. So that's the deal. Dick, any questions? I didn't have any questions coming on the email, but if anybody wants to email me, feel free to do so at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
So we think you can either use that website or nowadays by way of IRLP or Echolink in particular. During the net itself, you can send a message. John intercepts that and brings it to our attention. So Rosetta, real soon, is going to be intercepting a comet 67P. I believe New Horizon, which is heading for Pluto. I think it gets to Pluto in 2015. And when it comes to the Great Big Infrared Telescope, oh boy, I keep forgetting the name of the darn thing. I believe that was supposed to be launched in 2016 if it doesn't get delayed. I think it's in the summertime of 2015, very close to 1 year from now. New Horizons goes whizzing by Pluto. I believe very recently we discovered another one of those moons of Pluto. So we're discovering Pluto is more and more complicated. Too bad poor little Pluto used to be a nice, nice planet. All of a sudden, it's not a planet anymore. Oh, well. Let me pass it back to you for a couple of words on any of the above, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, Facebook, portion of the TechNet.
Yeah, well, I grew up thinking that was a planet. There were nine planets. That's it, as far as I'm concerned, there's nine planets. But, I didn't hear about the new moon, right? As far as I knew, they had five moons going around Pluto. And you're right, yeah, in 2015, almost, about 2 years from now, in July, you have New Horizons going to do a flyby of Pluto. Would have liked to see an orbiter come off of that. But then that's going to go out to the Kuiper Belt. Now, recently, they got approval to use the Hubble Space Telescope to stare at a patch of sky, said about the diameter of the moon out in that area where New Horizons is going. And what they're looking for is another suitable target for New Horizon after it leaves Pluto. So they're looking for a Kuiper Belt object. They call it KBO. They're looking for another KBO. They've discovered a number of these things. But they want one in that area where they don't have to do anything with trajectory too much. This way, somewhere down the road, they can photograph one of these things up close. So, and then your other thing was, was the James Webb Space Telescope, and that will be it's 2018. Not quite ready. They have the body of this thing, the frame of it, all this high-tech stuff that's going to be used for it right now inside of a monster vacuum chamber. They run all kinds of cryogenic tests on it, shaking tests, you name it. And they'll be sitting there for months on end, and they've got hundreds and hundreds of sensors, detectors, stress detectors, thermometers. they're running a full blast test on this thing that weighs a couple thousand pounds. Telescope, and then take it out and work on this, work on that, and put it back in again for another couple of few months. So, but that's coming along. It's an expensive project, but doing well. Let me drop it. It will be dropped. It'll be launched on an Ariane 5 rocket from French Guiana and then South America. Some people say, oh, that's not right, this is our project. Well, it's collectively, it does have a lot of countries involved with this, with a prime interest in this, just like European Space Agency has a prime interest in the Rosetta project. We have NASA stuff on board the Philip Lander and some of the components of the mothership itself. Well, one of the trade-offs for these projects is the science that you get back from it, and European Space Agency is interested in the what the space, the James Webb Space Telescope will give, and what they are contributing is a large piece of that by putting it on one of their rockets and launching it from South America. Kudek WS.
In the case of the Hubble Space Telescope, which arguably is the most productive piece of hardware that NASA ever made, I know that it sat in a warehouse for a long period of time before it finally got launched. When it finally got launched, they discovered this great big error in the mirror that Story Musgrave had to go up there and repair a couple of years later. So we had to wait a couple of extra years before Hubble finally became operational. But my goodness, was it worth the wait. Now, in the case of James Webb, which some people believe is going to be at least as productive as Hubble, but infrared as opposed to optical, it gives you a lot more penetration of space dust, the center of galaxies. You look at the black holes that we now slowly are discovering as the center of every galaxy, as one or more massive black holes that holds it all together. So the fact that it takes a couple of extra years of development to get it right is worth the wait, as I see it. Let's get it right, because there's only one of them. It's a fairly expensive project. and it's going to be launched in a fairly difficult place. Hubble has had, what, 5 major repair missions. It's never going to have a repair mission on James Webb. Better get it right the first time. It's being launched 1,000,000 miles away from the Earth, behind the Earth with reference to the Sun, at one of those Lagrange points. And it's going to stay there forever. And no human eye will ever see it. No human hand will ever touch it. No spacecraft will ever get there. It's in no man's land, literally. And so, get it right, because it's going to have huge capability. And it's a fairly high-risk project, as I see it. It's got a lot of individual mirror segments that have to slowly unfold and come to exactly the right position with micro-inches of accuracy on this thing that's... I forget the exact number, but you're going to tell me, Paul. I had to make a guess, it's in the vicinity of 10 meters in diameter, the main reflector on that thing. So it's a really big, and all kinds of very sensitive detectors on board. With 5 layers of sun shield to make sure that none of the solar energy gets to this very sensitive, cryogenically cooled infrared detector. Drop. So as I see, it's going to have many times more sensitivity than Hubble, in a more desirable location than Hubble, in a quieter zone, larger mirror, more sensitivity, new frequency region. If even half of it works, it's going to make discoveries. Whenever you look in a different frequency region with greater sensitivity, with a bigger mirror, with higher resolution, with a better location, with more sophisticated hardware, you're always making discoveries. A whole lot of surprises yet coming for us as to what the astrophotography and astrophysics, what's really going on. How do we get here? How much of that stuff is out there? And more evidence of multiverses. You think that this observable universe is the only one, and we just happen to be near the center of it? Dream on. I think we've been given that much special consideration? I doubt it. We've been humbled 5 times before. Started off with everybody absolutely positive that the center of the universe was the Earth and everything went around us. My goodness, were we arrogant. And so step by step, we've been, been downgraded as to how important are we and are we at the center of everything? I doubt it. And this is this observable universe, because our current hardware, let me drop it, our current space probe can only see a certain distance, and we call that the observable universe. And as you go out to the edge of that universe, does the stuff get decreased and just start getting sparse? I think that's true. And just go and stare at the ultra deep field Hubble Space Telescope picture, where they chose a dark chunk of sky where they thought almost nothing was there, stared at it for 1,000,000 seconds, integrated that picture, and the picture has 2,600 galaxies that have never been seen before. And on average, each galaxy has 100 billion stars. And that's out at the perimeter of what we can observe. You think it's getting sparse out there? No way in hell. You think that's the end? And that with all that extra stuff out there, that there's no more beyond that, just because that's the limit of your current telescope? If you believe that, and I'm going to sell you a piece of the Verrazano Bridge. I'm selling Verrazano these days instead of Brooklyn. Okay. A bunch of opinions, as you can tell, Paul. You might want to add something to any of the above. WS2N, K2LIW. Hey, K2LIW. Yeah, stand by a minute, Paul. Okay? Go ahead.
Hi, question for Paul. Before, did you say the Rosetta was going to orbit at the planet? I'm just wondering if it's possible. I haven't been reading anything about Rosetta at all, so I don't know. But orbit it, wouldn't it? They have to be gravitationally attracted, or do you know how? Do you read anything about how they are, how it's going to orbit the planet? Over to you, Paul.
Well, yeah, in August, we've got a couple of more months, it will go into orbit. Right now, it's slowing down. I read it about a month ago how speed that it was slowing down. By the time it gets to where it's got to go, it'll be down to like 1 meter per second. Rosetta has thrust the sun and put itself into orbit, and that's what it's going to stay. And in November, they will have the lander stay, and it will still send it right down. It's going to attach itself, actually physically attach itself to the comet somehow. So that, you know, if they don't, it'll bounce right off the gravitational pull so little. Yeah, that's the present plan. And that dip, by the way, is 21 feet, I think, was the number. Meters was like 7.5 meters with the diameter of that thing. 18 segmented hexagon shaped mirrors that they made all out of beryllium and everything. Warm and all, so it's an expensive project. Yeah, I think that's it, okay. Yeah. Back to you there, okay, for any comments.
Very cool. Thank you, Paul, for your input. And we're back to the net. That's Dick with the DCLR.
There's a little bit more to this, okay. You've asked an interesting question. You give me a great opportunity to give you a piece of brand new information I learned a week and a half ago when I gave this puzzle to people of putting a rocket on the moon. Before I answer that one, Paul, roughly what is the diameter of the Rosetta 67P comet? Roughly what diameter is it, Paul?
I don't know, but you know, it describes things on the internet when you read things like this. I didn't see it in a magazine. It would have been more exact, I'm sure. But they describe it like this, the size of Manhattan. So what is it, 8 miles or something like that? I don't know what the diameter is. I'll check. Back to you.
That's more than close enough. Approximately the size of Manhattan. By my standards, that's a big chunk of stuff. This is not some little bone in space. Something as big as Manhattan. You walk from Battery to the northern end of Manhattan, and you suddenly realize that's a big chunk of land. And if you take a potato-shaped object that's that big, you call it a comet, it's got significant gravity. And so whenever you fly by some other gravity-conducting object, another planet, another comet, an asteroid, whatever, as you fly by, depending on how you adjust your trajectory, you get a kick from it. You end up going away from it at a slightly different angle, at a slightly higher velocity than usual. But you don't go in orbit for a very good reason. As you approach something that's got gravity, like you start approaching the moon. Apollo did is that how do you use enough rocket power to get 90% of the way there? After that, you glide toward the moon because the moon's gravity, by inverse square law, is a hell of a lot stronger than Earth's gravity. The moon will suck you in. And then you know that when the astronauts went behind the moon, they had to do a orbit insertion burn. Let me drop it. You had to do a rocket blast to slow down, to stay in orbit. If not, they would have done a figure eight and come right back to the Earth immediately. That's the way it was planned. So whenever you approach some other object, it sucks you in, you speed up in the process, and you go whizzing by. What's required to go into orbit? Well, what's required to go into a gravity assist? If your kinetic energy of velocity is greater than your potential energy of altitude away from that body, if the speed is greater, in other words, you go whizzing by in a path that mathematically is called a hyperbola, so it's a hyperbolic path. If your speed, if the kinetic energy of your speed and the potential energy of your altitude away from that thing that you're going by is equal, and you're going to fly by with a parabolic path, a certain shape of path. When you do that retro burn, so that you slow down, so that your kinetic energy of velocity is lower than your potential energy of altitude, then by definition, you're in an elliptical orbit around that object. Almost always it requires a retro burn to do that. When, Kepler, I think is the name of the satellite that went in orbit around Saturn. I think it had to make something like a 30-minute burn in order to slow down as it got to Saturn, in order to get into orbit around Saturn? Is that roughly what was required of them, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
It was like a 48-minute burn, and his name was, is Cassini, still operating quite good there. That's it. But, that Manhattan number, that's not written down in stone now. So I look that up, or somebody else does. That might be off, so can't say for sure yet.
Interesting. Okay. Do you happen to know how big that comet is, West, WS2N, K2IW?
No, I'm sorry. I was just waiting for my turn.
Understand. So, as you can see, Kay, you have to do something active to get into orbit. You don't just go there and automatically you're in orbit. As you get sucked in by the gravity of that other body, you're going to go whizzing by almost always. So you have to do a retro burn to slow down to get into that orbit. And that's what Rosetta is going to do with that comet. Okay. Thank you, Paul. And now, Wes, what's the latest on your particular project, Wes? In 2XJN, K2LIW?
Interesting. I'm going to come back to the cross cable property, the cross cable versus the signal that is traveling on it. I wonder if you had a chance to look at the video that I was sending you before. That's some interesting material. Roy is helping me amazingly, and Dick as well, John as well, let me go. And I have a lot of projects. I've got right now some other materials. Maybe you have a time. I think it's worth your time. But I'm going to send it so you have a time to view it. My question is, when we're going to the coaxial cable that is shorted at the end and the frequency is pretty low, which is 20 kHz, 15 kHz, then that kind of structure is more capacitive than inductive. Is it right, wrong? And then eventually, another part of the question would be, we have a forward wave and then we have reflected wave, and they don't see each other. Then the question would be about the hot point. Enter it here.
Check 4 kilometers in diameter, that's what they said. Four kilometers.
Okay, that's a little bit small.
By 3, I looked it up too.
Okay, that's a little smaller than Manhattan, but 4 kilometers still is a big piece of space stuff. It's got local gravity.
It's diameter, not length.
Doesn't matter. It's still a big piece of stuff by my standards. If you start calculating the mass, the amount of weight, the number of kilograms of something that's 4 kilometers in diameter, that's a lot of mass. You've got to do something active. You've got to make a burn to go into orbit. It's not going to happen automatically. Is that the way you see it, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Oh, no. They're going to have not a big burn. I mean, they got thrusters on this thing. That's probably going to be good enough. And you're good with all this stuff, Dick. 3.14 times 10 to the 12, plus or minus 0.21 times 10 to the 12 kilograms. I'd have to sit down for a week and figure that one out. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, a 10 to the 9 is giga, 10 to the 12 is tera. So 3 times 10 to the 12 teragrams. That's a lot of grams, or a tera kilograms. Doesn't matter. It's heavy. You don't want to go smashing into that thing. So you're going to have to do a burn to get into orbit. It's got gravity. Not a lot. I'm going to guess that if you were standing on the surface of that thing, you're going to see something like 5% of the Earth's gravity. I haven't done that calculation yet, but we know how to do that. And so you would be very light. Would you be able to jump off of that... Would your human muscles be able to give you enough velocity to create escape velocity when you jumped off of that?
Who
is a slim possibility, yes. And could you go bouncing up and down on a thing and really, really do some fancy high jumping? Of course. But still, you have to make a burn to get into orbit around it. Is that the way you see it, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Oh, yeah, I agree. But once they do it, I think they'll be successful. They'll be able to get that landed down there, and then we'll be able to follow the history of this thing when it eventually has a tail and everything going after, you know, behind the comet, behind the sun. The comet will pop out the other side. It should be, it's going to be fantastic. Back to you.
Now, Wes mentioned the word Roy. Roy is AC2GS, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. Roy lives in West 2nd Street in Brooklyn. Unfortunately, where Roy is located, in particular QTH, is the wrong number of miles from his repeater. He doesn't have the right antenna yet, so he's not able to give us a nice clean signal into this particular repeater, therefore report to us live. But he has been writing a series of emails. John, me, Wes, Glenn, I can tell that Roy has a very strong physics background. Whether or not he's a teacher of the subject, he should be, if he's not. I think quite possibly he is a physics teacher. So he's been writing various white paper is not quite the right word for it, but explanation emails, sometimes 5, 7, 9 paragraphs long, in which he's explaining to all of us some of the physics of what Wes is involved in. And in some cases, he's bringing our feet back down to the ground because, in some cases, Wes is attempting to do things that are a little bit more difficult than first meets the eye. So somebody in Brooklyn is going to have to volunteer to help Roy have a slightly higher gain antenna on his roof so that he can report to us live on the TechNet. I'd certainly love to hear his voice live. WS2N, K2LIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, I'm very much delighted with the fact that John and Roy are really putting a lot of time to go forward. I have a new material for three of you gentlemen, and I believe this one is worth your time. It's a quite nice article, pretty much kept in the scientific format, and the guy is really impressive. Now, I was checking up on plenty of stuff that he was doing, but it's not what I'm trying to ask. I don't know if you had a chance to go through the videos that I have sent you, but my question for today is, we have a short coaxial cable, what I've pointed at before, and what happened to the coaxial cable between quarter wave bumps. Now, additional thing, the impedance of the transmitter does not necessarily match 50 ohms. The coax is operating at frequency below 20 kHz. Then, should not have so many questions at the beginning of, we have forward wave and a reflected wave, and they don't see each other. Now, what would you say about hot points? And to issue.
You're saying the right words in some cases here, Wes. Whenever you have a standing wave ratio on a cable, in your particular case, you're putting something close to a short circuit at the end of a coax cable. Therefore, the signal flows down, hits the short circuit, reverses 180 degrees at the short circuit, and essentially all of the signal will be reflected back. Of the signal reflects back towards the signal source, what happens next? And that reverse signal doesn't see the forward signal. They're thoroughly independent events in my method of analysis of standing wave ratio. I'll give you some warning that everyone's going to agree with that one. I've had some very long discussions with some pretty smart people on that one. And sometimes we have to agree to disagree. But I've analyzed things that way, and that method of modeling mentally for me has worked for all of my years of working with transmission lines and designing antennas. For me, that model works. It may not be perfect, but it's good enough. Let me drop. And of the signal that reflects back, if the signal generator was really a 50-ohm source, and almost any self-respecting signal generator made by Hewlett-Packard, Agilent, Rode Schwartz, whatever, as long as you're using the output attenuator more than 10 dB below maximum power output, that output attenuator does give you very close to a 50-ohm Thevenin source impedance. Therefore, of the reflected signal back to the signal generator, in that circumstance, the signal generator acts like a nearly perfect dummy load for the reflected signal, and it all gets absorbed. And the action of that particular wave going out and coming back, that event, so to speak, ends. But then, of course, you're continuously sending out signals, and there's another event. Life gets very complicated if you're using some kind of a non-50-ohm signal generator. A signal generator where you've cranked it up to maximum power output, or if it really is a tetrode tube or a silicon transistor, they tend to be constant current generators. They tend to be really an open circuit. Of the signal that reflects back to that kind of a signal generator, it cannot be absorbed. It gets re-reflected forward again. And now the signal bounces back and forth, and depending on the exact number of wavelengths of the signal of the cable, now those signals become co-phase, anti-phase. You get all kinds of effects. You get a scalloping response as you sweep it in frequency, because those bouncing signals are now going in phase and out of phase with each other. So life gets quite complicated if your signal generator is not 50 ohms. But you have the ability to use your signal generators with a 10 dB output attenuator, forcing it to be a 50 ohm source. Therefore, each bounce is only one single bounce. The fact that the coaxial cable is wound into a coil, as far as the signal flowing down the center of this cable is concerned, almost does not matter. When I take a coax cable and make a few turns and wrap it together with tape near my antenna as a poor man's balance, the signal flowing down the center of the cable does not know it is in a coil. All it sees is that signal is flowing down the center conductor. Nearby, it sees the outer conductor. It says, I'm in a piece of coax cable. The fact that the piece of coax cable is curved, it doesn't give a darn. It just keeps right on flowing. Only if the signal gets out of the cable and gets into an unbalanced method of feeding a dipole, then for the first time, you're able to launch some signal back down the outside of the coax cable, and now you get some other funny effects. And it's the reason you put that coil near the antenna to act as an RF choke to limit how much of that signal launched on the outside of the cable can flow back down all the way to the shack. That's why you put that coil there. That coil is there only for the signal on the outside of the cable. You're not doing it for the signal inside the cable. Let me drop. Now, the one slight catch to this thing is that as you go to lower and lower frequencies, what you think is a beautiful shielded piece of coax cable, even if it has 99% braid coverage, even if it's RG9 or RG214 cable, where it's got double braid, a silver-plated inner braid and a non-silver-plated outer braid, you get all kinds of thickness of braid there, which gives you a very strong connector. Even in that case, if you go to a low enough frequency, the skin depth of signal pump penetrating your beautiful copper conductor, the skin depth increases. It's a 1 over frequency square root phenomenon. Go to a low enough frequency, the skin depth starts becoming a big number, and some of the signal leaks out of the cable, even if it's got really thorough braid. So at 20 kilohertz, are you below the number where the signal leaks out? I know at 60 hertz, it definitely leaks out. I know that at 1 megahertz, it does not leak out. At 20 kilohertz, we're sort of into that gray zone. Is the signal thoroughly shielded, or is it starting to leak? And if there is any signal leaking out of the braid of the cable at 20 kilohertz, and the cable is now into a coil, yes, you could be exciting some signal into that coil, and if you have another nearby coil, with a capacitor encrusted as a resonator. You could be coupling some signal from the leakage of the first cable into that second coil. So these are a bunch of my opinions as to what I know so far with N2SJN. N2SJN. K2LIW.
Yeah, there is change. Thank you for that. Now we have forward going signal and reflected signal. By the definition, they don't see each other. One question. They don't see each other at any time, any position. Or they don't see each other if the frequency, if the impedance of the generator matches the impedance of the ground cable. And also, what's happening in the hotspot? Interfere.
Okay, now we're getting to a controversial area where not everybody's going to agree with what I say. What I am saying is that on most linear transmitting media, whether it be pebbles dropped into a pool of water and you watch waves travel north to south, south to north, and fade through each other, and pass through each other with essentially no reaction, whether I'm hitting the guy wire on my tower and I watch a pulse go up the guy wire, hit the tower, which is a short circuit, the pulse reverses in polarity, comes back down to me. While the pulse is on the way down, I hit the guy wire again, create another pulse on the way up, and I watch those two pulses fold through each other with no interaction. So therefore, by way of the pool of water, by way of the guy wire, I can see this crazy phenomenon where the forward going signal has its pointing vector, reverse going signal has its pointing vector. Those two signals fold from each other with essentially no interaction, as long as I haven't made the pulse so big that I'm stretching the guy wire and I'm getting a nonlinear effect. As long as I haven't made the wave in the pool of water so big that I'm starting to get white caps and I'm getting a nonlinear effect. Or in the case of a coax cable, as long as the signal isn't so big that I'm arcing over the cable and I get a nonlinear effect. As long as I've kept things down to an amplitude of signal going forward and reverse, that everything is behaving in a linear manner, then those two signals do not see each other. But there's a catch. Let me drop. Yes, there is a forward going signal. Yes, there is a reverse going signal. Yes, the two signals and certain portions of the cable, the forward going signal and the reverse going signal, because of the standing waves you set up, if for instance I've got a reflective signal generator, the signal generator is not 50 ohms, and I've got a short circuit at the end of the cable, and I've carefully chosen the length of the cable to be some odd or even number of quarter wavelengths, so I'm in one of the resonance modes. Now you're going to find places in the cable where the forward going signal and the reverse going signal are in phase a lot of the time, and you're getting a kind of amplification. You put a non-directional probe in there, like you do with a slotted line, you'll find a bigger signal there. And at some other place, a quarter wavelength away, where the in phase and out, where the signals are out of phase, forward and reverse, you see cancellation. So as you slide your non-directional probe on your slotted line, you find some places where you hear a peak, other places where you measure a valley. The ratio between the two, we call it standing wave ratio. Well, you got to be careful now how you judge this. That peak is because you're using a non-directional probe. If the probe on that slotted line, let me drop. If that probe on that slotted line was a directional coupler, it would see nothing but the forward going signal. As you slide the probe along the slotted line, there would be no change in amplitude. As you reverse the probe, if there is a directional coupler, and you look at the reverse signal, it measures the reverse signal. And as you slide it along the slotted line, there'd be no change in amplitude. There'd be no standing wave. So it's only when you use a non-directional sensing device, where you now add together for the first time in your probe, you are adding the forward signal that you're sensing, in the probe you're adding the reverse signal that you're sensing, in the probe you're adding them together. The probe is not part of that beautiful, pure 50-ohm coaxial cable. It is a disturbance of the cable. And in the probe, which is non-directional, it sees forward and reverse, and you see a peak in certain directions, you see a valley in other directions. You also see a similar effect. Let me drop. You see a similar effect when you hold your handy talkie. You're listening to a weak repeater signal, and you hold your handy talkie in various places in the room. And you hold the handy talkie horizontal, vertical, pointing forward, pointing back. You'll find certain places in the room where you'll find peaks and valleys of signal that you're listening to, and you're using your handy talkie and its rubber duck antenna as a probe. It's a non-directional probe. You'll find peaks and valleys because it's non-directional. Did the signal really cancel in that position? Absolutely not. The signal that flows from that repeater from north to south, that flows to your house, is relatively uniform as it flows through the house if there wasn't multipath going on. And the other signal coming from down south to north is flowing through your house and is relatively uniform in every position in your house. But when you use a non-directional probe called rubber duck, and the rubber duck doesn't give a damn if the signal comes from north, south, east, west, up, down, it adds them all together. And now in that non-directional probe, as you move it around, you'll find peaks and valleys, and you'll think they're annulled. Not necessarily. All those signals from all of those radio stations flowing through your head, flowing through your house, flowing through your hand, flowing past your antenna, they all have no interaction with each other. All those signals of all of those transmitters in the New York City area, all those signals in free space, in air, in that pure medium, they all flow through each other with absolutely no interaction. Unless one of those signals is so potent that, let me drop a quick. Unless one of those signals is so potent that it arcs over the air, makes a plasma, and now you've got a nonlinear medium, and now you get mixing action. But until you make that medium nonlinear, all those signals flow through each other with no interaction. I'm very disappointed that the books on transmission lines don't explain it that way. They give you a bunch of equations you're supposed to figure out what's going on. As you can tell, I've got a mental model of how radio signals propagate through waveguides, transmission lines, antennas, and whatever, and the model works for me. It's good enough. It's allowed me to develop antennas. It's allowed me to file for patents. It's worked well enough for me. Is the model perfect? I don't know. Nobody knows. Nobody has ever seen a radio wave. You make a mental model of you think what you think it is. And if your model is good enough, for most of the experiments you conduct, the model continues to work. And if you're objective enough and you find the model stops working, then you're going to have to improve the model. You're going to have to add some extra engineering change notices, you're going to ECN, you're going to have to add some extra things to the model. Very similar to what happened to Rutherford, Thompson, and everybody else. In the beginning, they thought a molecule had a hard core in the center and an electron going around it. And if there's multiple electrons on that particular element, well, they all move around like planets going around the sun. Beautiful model in the beginning. Much too simplistic. For real molecules, the real model is a hell of a lot more complicated. Those orbits are not simple, planar orbits of electrons going around the nucleus, because those electrons are strongly electrically negative in polarity. They resist each other. They repel each other like crazy. Therefore, they got some very crazy hybrid suborbital type orbits around that nucleus in order to simultaneously
repeat it. Time out.
Simultaneously be in orbit around that nucleus, but repelling each other as much as possible and spending most of their time as far away from each other as possible. Planets going around the sun do not see each other. They don't have to repel each other. So the model of planets going around the sun and the model of electrons going around the nucleus, very different. The model had to be improved. So my model of how a radio wave goes down a transmission line, for the time being, it's good enough for me and it works. And I'm telling you as much as I know about that, because I've never seen that radio wave. I've got to make a mental model of what I think it looks like and the way I think it behaves. And for me, the model so far works. I haven't found too many exceptions yet, but there may be. Maybe this helps a little, Wes. WS2N, K2LIW, Kirkland. N2XJN, K2LIW. You got it, Wes.
N2XJN. The question that I gave you also about the hotspot. It does take a course, and in a certain point you see the hotspot. So my question is, should we treat that normally forward and reverse deflected wave doesn't hit each other, but we have the point of disturbance in the hotspot. Now, we got to remember that if the frequency of the transmitter is higher than the frequency of resonance of that sort of shorted line, then we have no phase flip. So I would like to know some more about hotspots. I appreciate
it. Because you've set up a standing wave, if you assume now you've got a short circuit at the far end of the coax, you've got a transmitter that's not a 50 ohm load, and you've got a specific length of transmission line which is a resonant length. So therefore there is there are fixed positions where the signal flowing forward, the signal flowing reverse, spend most of the time in phase with each other at a certain spot in the cable. Therefore, the total amount of current flowing through the copper of that cable is higher in that spot. Therefore, that spot gets physically hotter. And so, yeah, because you get hot spots every half wavelength spaced, and you get other cold spots half wavelength spaced, where the voltage is maximum. And by the way, when it comes to the cable getting hot, usually at low frequencies, the cable gets hot because of current. If you're at the high microwave frequencies, where the hot spots now occur because the higher voltage portions of the signal give you more dielectric loss. But so, at the frequencies you operate, the hot spots are because current is concentrated in certain areas. The forward flowing wave, the reverse flowing wave, spends more time in phase at that position of the cable. Therefore, the current is higher at that position of the cable, and it gets hot. But that extra heat is not necessarily a nonlinearity. Every half wave, if you've got careful thermal imaging camera and you measure the temperature of the cable, you will find every half wave a hot spot when you have a resonance phenomenon. Over to US, K2RIW.
My question is, when you have the frequency of the transmitter higher than the frequency of resonance of the transmission line is shorted, then we have no flip in phase. Should then we say that reflected wave C is traveling forward? Patricia.
If I've got a absorptive signal generator, 50 ohm signal generator, and if I'm operating at a non-resonant frequency of the cable, I think the hot spots disappear. And by the way, it's a slow phenomenon. If I slowly increase the signal generator frequency and I'm walking away from the resonance and I'm looking at the cable with a thermal imaging camera, those hot spots will look like they're spreading out and eventually become even heat everywhere as you get away from resonance. It isn't a black and white digital yes and no situation. As I walk away from resonance, I'll watch those hot spots slowly spread apart and eventually become even everywhere on that cable. What if that helps with? Into XJN, K2RIW.
A little bit confused. Does the forward and reflected see each other when it's in phase and when it's flipped 180 degrees?
In my mental model, the forward wave and the reverse wave never see each other. In resonance, out of resonance, no matter. They never see each other. Now you're about to ask, okay, how in the world do you get hotspots? Okay, because you set up a resonance condition, obvious by your slotted line experiment, you'll find out there's a certain spot where the voltage is higher, there's a certain spot where the voltage is low, but the current is higher. And the places where the current is higher, you look at that center conductor with your thermal imaging camera, you will see more heat. Because as your probe is telling you, at that particular position, your probe on your slotted line is telling you that at that particular position, the voltage always looks high. The forward going wave and the reverse going wave, because of resonance, are always in phase at that point. At some other point, a quarter wavelength away, they're always out of phase. Therefore, you're going to see, with your camera, you're going to see these hot spots on the cable. That doesn't mean that the signal going forward and reverse suddenly is seeing each other. You're looking at a
RAW-IW here. Wes, I think I'm hearing you right now, and John, are you hearing Wes? KC2WGB, K2RIW? Okay. I think I answered his main question. You guys just heard TechNet number 1511 of the series that began September of 1982. As long as John and I and Hal and Paul stay healthy, we'll be back next week. We'll dig a little bit deeper.
I think I can hear.
Okay, I did make the main point, Wes, that yes, you see hotspots. Yes, you could think that the forward and reverse wave are seeing each other. You're seeing a response of the cable seeing the forward and reverse signal at that resonance, at that particular point on the cable. Those two signals are in phase. Your slotted line probe would have shown you more signal in that point. That's the peak versus the valley of the spending wave ratio you measure as you move that probe up and down. So the cable is seeing in-phase voltages, and other places are seeing in-phase current. So therefore, the signals forward and reverse adding up create more heat in the cable at that point. That's a cable response. It's not a signal response. It doesn't mean the forward and reverse signal have seen each other. You can make that interpretation. I do not. My model says they never see each other as long as I keep the system linear. A hot piece of cable is not nonlinear. N2XJN, K2RIW. I agree with that. Cable always has loss. And that the places where the current is maximum, the I squared R loss of the cable will be greater than those positions. So yes, cable's always got loss. And now when you set up a resonance standing wave ratio condition, the loss of the cable becomes maximum in certain locations and less in other locations. You haven't changed the loss of the cable. You've just distributed the loss in this bumpy manner along the cable because you set up a resonant standing wave ratio condition. Over you, Wes.
I've got a much more clear picture, thanks to you, and it means that if we have a perfect match at 50 ohms at the end of the coaxial cable, then we don't have a hotspot, because then the energy is dissipated through the 50 ohm load at radio.
You got it. Yes, as I usually say, if the cable has a pure 50 ohm load at the far end, the signal flows down the cable once, every single bit of the cable gets equal amount of heat, with one slight exception. If it's a 1,000-foot long piece of cable, obviously the signal is weaker by the time it gets down to the 1,000-foot end, so the rate of heating down there is a little bit lower. But if I look at each 5-foot length of cable, I'm going to see equal heating when there is no standing wave ratio. You got it. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay, I understand that. Thank you for that. Now, if we have the end of the cable shorted, no. Let's have a scenario. We have the end of the cable with the load 50 ohms, but the transmitter is not 50 ohms. N2XJN.
Hey, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I turned it back on a few guys.
Yeah, we're essentially finished. We're at the tail end here. We're going to have to discuss these details a little bit later next week, Wes. We made some progress. And so as I was saying earlier, this was TechNet number 1511. We'll be back next week. 73-year-old, try to be kind to each other. By way of some of the not-so-pleasant things that were happening from time to time, I can tell that somebody out there is angry. He's hearing people enjoying themselves, passing information back and forth. Something is going on in his life, in my speculation, that's not making him happy. And he has made the mistake of thinking that he can stop us from having happiness, that he's going to be happier. Of course, that's crazy. He's wasting his time. Can he go to the nearest bar and brag to his friends? Oh, I jammed the hell out of them. Are they going to respect him for that? Man is a social animal. That person is possibly not a social animal.